This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
We are so excited to welcome Bishop Ryan. Welcome, Bishop Ryan. This is a funny thing. I just don't know if y'all know this dynamic, but Bishop Ryan and I have known each other for close to 30 years, actually. When I was a priest in the Diocese of Dallas in McKinney, she came to the Church of the Ascension in Dallas, and the bishop, the then canon of the ordinary, said that we should know each other. And so we met and we became friends and we colleagues, and then we were side by side and often back to back in the Diocese of Dallas. Then she came to the Diocese of Texas, I came to the Diocese of Texas, canon of the ordinary, and now my lady bishop. So it's really fun. It's really fun to have a long run like that. So it's just great to be, well, I was thinking about that today in the liturgy, just standing there together. I was like, this is just very cool. So personally, it's a nice thing to have you. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. And so we're lucky enough at St. David's this year, we got two bishop visits, which is lovely. That makes it so much more fun. And Bishop Doyle was here in the spring. And he did confirmations and had a formal meeting with the vestry and all that. And Kay's here to do confirmations again. Our confirmands are on the front. So if you're a confirmand, stand up so the congregation can see your face. Yeah. So we have confirmands, receptions, and reaffirmations, right? So confirmands are people, like you know, are being confirmed. Receptions are people who are coming into the church from other partner denominations that we're in communion with. And reaffirmation is if you're in a place in your life where you feel like the Spirit's doing something different and moving you into a deeper relationship with God and with the church, you can do a formal public declaration of that. And that's what a reaffirmation is. So I think we have some of all that. So it's
awesome.
Very exciting.
Very exciting.
All right, well, Bishop Ryan, you are the suffragan bishop of the Western region of the diocese. That is a mouthful. Can you tell us what your job actually is?
Sure. So suffragan bishop is one of the kinds of assisting bishops in a diocese and elected by the diocese and serves at the diocese's pleasure until we resign or retire. And so I'm one of two. Each diocese can only have two suffragans. I'm one of the two suffragans. We have other assisting bishops. And my job is to oversee the West region, which is four convocations. Think about it geographically. It starts up by Waco and goes down to Matagorda. It's a strip. And in that strip, there are 70 congregations, about 69, I think, now. And there are church plants and campus missions and some other random things. And so I oversee those congregations. And then I also, each assisting bishop has a portfolio for the diocese. And my portfolio includes chairing the boards of St. Stephen's Episcopal School, Seminary of the Southwest, and El Buen Samaritano. And just want to shout out to Gustavo, who is here in the room, who's my executive chair at El Buen Samaritano. And you know that the executive chairs are the ones who make things happen because the bishop who chairs too many boards can't do it all. And then I also oversee the ordination process and the clergy formation just after ordination. So I'm the executive for ministry for the diocese.
Very good.
So that's sort of the scope.
Very good. And then she has free time to do other things. That's a big job. That is a lot going on. Thank you. I just think it's helpful for them to know. I mean, it's such a big diocese, and y'all have varying responsibilities. So when a bishop appears that's not the diocese, I don't think it's good to find out what's the areas of your focus. So today is Confirmation and Reaffirmation Sunday, as I said. And we're very excited about this step in your life. And I just wanted to know, what do you remember about your own confirmation that Sunday? What was it like for you?
Well, first of all, it wasn't on a Sunday. It was a weeknight.
Okay.
I was 12. My sister, who was about 2 years older than me, was confirmed the same night. We had a big confirmation class, and adults and kids. And I dressed myself. And I'm the youngest of four children, all girls. So I wore a lot of hand-me-downs in my life. And so I'm in the picture, I am wearing a white dress that's too short, shoes that should have been handed down to Goodwill or the trash. And I am holding my Good News Bible across my chest, and I have a big grin on my face. So I remember being dressed in a, you know, this is the plight of the fourth child.
That's right. Oh, sure. Sure. Well, I appreciate you explaining that, because I thought most people at 12 generally can dress themselves.
It wasn't so much that I couldn't dress myself, but knowing what was appropriate the occasion.
So. That's all right. That is a strong tradition here at St. David's. We have a lot of kids who have a lot of liberty about what they wear. I think it's fantastic. You know, it is a far cry from St. Paul's Waco, super buttoned up, little blue blazer and a little white dress. That's confirmation. That's so Judge is in the blue blazer. So we're glad Dustin was. So very good. So as you think about the place that confirmation holds in the life of faith, can you talk to us about how confirmation sits in your own life? What did it start, or how did it influence where you are now?
Well, in my own life, and in sort of, I grew up in a church where we, in the Episcopal Church, where we were taught as youth that confirmation was taking responsibility for your faith. And there were certain things that went with that. Like we were taught about stewardship, and we were expected to turn in a pledge card before we were confirmed, even at 12.
Okay.
I think mine was like 27 cents a month or something, you know.
Okay.
But it held that place. And of course, I was confirmed, even though I was confirmed in like 1977, we had the beginnings of the fruits of liturgical reform.
Okay.
So the baptismal covenant that calls us to live our faith in a way that changes how we are in the world. And I don't think the bishop said anything about it, or if he did, I don't remember it, but the confirmation teachers, it's like you have a ministry and you have to ask God to help you find it. And so that's how it's shaped me. And of course, what I remember of that day may also be what I remember of those years.
Sure.
In a community that really valued young people, invited us into real leadership, and called upon us to take our faith seriously. I got a prayer book. I didn't get it at confirmation because we were in the middle of the liturgical reform, and my mother didn't want to buy me a book that then was going to be out of, you know. And so I got the prayer book a couple of years later, but the first devotion in my life, regular devotion, was reading a psalm every night, or a portion if it was a really long psalm. And that's how I got sort of into the rhythm of the daily office and daily prayer was as a result of confirmation and things people invited me to.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And if you pay attention, confirmants, because then you might just be sitting in a chair with a mitre on your head. But this is a big deal. just move that into to talk to our friends who are being presented today, and the rest of us as well. Sort of, what do you think are what's the invitation and the demand really of confirmation in the Christian life?
I think the invitation is to believe that God has created each of us as people gifted, and each one of us is gifted in different ways, and that the world's needs are great, and God sees those needs and invites us to invest our gifts and our attention and our love in responding to the world in the ways that God would, as God does through us. And I think that it's, right, it is a responsibility, and that may feel a little heavy. But it's also the promises of joy, right? That when we actually trust ourselves and God enough to invest our gifts, that we find joy in the service that is before us. And I think it's important that we, not just at confirmation, right? So at some point in our life, at whatever age, that we claim for ourselves the faith, perhaps that either we claimed when we were too young to quite understand, or when somebody else claimed it for us, that we claim it for ourselves, but also that there are times in our lives where we intentionally reaffirm because we've come to an understanding, we've come through a difficult time or a time of grief, we've come through a time of distance from God or the church. And so it's that invitation again and again to like take seriously those promises and remember, oh yeah, once I did that. And I want to renew that.
Well, and that's the ongoing thing, isn't it? I mean, we're constantly renewed. We're constantly being invited beyond where we are into a deeper knowledge of this good news of Jesus.
Indeed.
And into action and behaviors in the world that reflect that. And just so you all know, the prayer book makes provision for this. I mean, we do it every time we reaffirm our baptismal covenant. You're reaffirming the promises you're making today. You know, every time you see someone baptized, we all say these things. Every time you see someone confirmed, we all say these things. But then there are other liturgies in the prayer book that you can look at that help us mark other steps in our lives that call for a deeper commitment in life and faith. And one is even quite a quite literal one. Like if you decide to step into work that you clearly see as God's work, I don't mean ordination necessarily, but you know, you're going to go work for the Peace Corps, or you're going to go to work at Trinity Center in a homeless shelter or something that is clear outreach and ministry. There's a formal liturgy for that, that we can do in the Sunday liturgy to help mark that for you. So just know those resources are there, liturgical resources to help with this spiritual reality that Kay's talking about.
Well, and I want to just note that in all of those services, you'll notice it in the service today or any other time you're at baptism or confirmation, also at weddings and ordinations, and in a commitment to Christian service, is that the congregation is asked a question that sounds something like this. Will you do all in your power to support these persons in their marriage, in their life in Christ, and whatever? And that's a communal thing that we share in, that we're always called to be for each other, those sources of support that'll help us do what we promise to do.
Thank you. All right, we're going to shift because you've had a really big summer. You and I were at General Convention together in Baltimore. Then you and our other elected bishops went to the Lambeth Conference in England. Shortly after that, I think like 10 days or less after General Convention was over, you were off to Lambeth. So let's talk about both of those things kind of briefly. We don't have time to do it all. Where did you see the Holy Spirit at work in General Convention? Where do you see the light of Christ kind of in our greater denomination?
Well, I'll say just three pretty brief things about General Convention. Okay. One is that the Spirit, right? General Convention was shortened from 8 days to 4 because of COVID in order to try and get us in and out before we had the super spreader terrible thing. And the people's spirit about what was required to deal with the legislation, both before and during, I think was a place where I saw God at work. Just really remarkable. People could have been really cranky or resistant or irresponsible. And instead, we tried to do really well what we could do in the time we had. And that meant that we made some bold decisions that maybe if we had had longer to debate, we might have nuanced in ways that were more careful, but still important. So that's one thing. Okay. Second thing is that this is the first General Convention when I sat in the House of Bishops for extended periods as a member. And what I discovered is that, so House of Bishops is like 150 people, and the House of Deputies, where the lay people and clergy serve, is like 900 people. And so in the House of Bishops, we move faster, which means that we have times when we can actually have deep conversation about things that are before the church. And that happened as we talked about the prayer book revision process and liturgy. It happened when we talked about a letter about climate change. And it was just the way the Spirit was there in our really careful listening to each other across difference was commented on by many bishops who have been there many times, that there was something about that this time that was really significant. And then the third thing is, what was the third thing? I don't know what the third thing was. It might have been the...
I think it's because one thing, when you shorten General Convention to 4 days instead of eight, they take out all the fun stuff. Just saying.
No.
And so we sat a lot and did very heavy duty legislative work and deep prayers. But that non-defined hanging out before and after, that was all gone because everybody was being responsible. So I felt like it was much more... It was very business based and much more serious, I think, is the way I would say it, than other general conventions.
Well, and I think the third thing is this, is that I think it's important to know as you all hear things about general convention, particularly about this one, the way that our rules of order work, we have to pass, the House of Bishops has to vote on something in the same language that the House of Deputies has to vote on it. And so normally in a longer convention, something can come before one of the houses, there can be debate, there can be revisions and amendments, and then it goes back to the committee and the other house to consider. And there's time for it to go back and forth to get it, sort of tighten it down and get it right. And there was none of that time. So what that meant was that some things didn't get dealt with at all. And some things where we felt it very important to make a decision and to say something got decided in ways that aren't perfect. And so you might hear, and I'll name it, not to get into a controversy, but I'll name it because I think it's important in Texas. One of the things that was passed was a call upon the church to advocate for access to healthcare for trans children and adults. And it's stated very broadly in ways that might make people cringe and have led to the Episcopal Church being accused of advocating for, you know, mutilation of children or something crazy, which is not what we were doing.
Of course.
But given the legislative action in many states across the country, certainly the House of Bishops felt like it was really important to pass a statement calling upon the church out of compassion to claim that. And there was no time to get rid of the all people at all. You know, I mean, it's just, right. So just to know that that's part of the result, that when we have to do it fast, it's going to be messier. It's not perfected. But still, sometimes it's important to act.
So let's jump to Lambeth Conference as well. Same questions about what did you see there that would be helpful for us to know?
So first of all, Lambeth is all about relationships. Lambeth is not a legislative body like General Convention. When Lambeth does pass resolutions, they're not binding because each province is a church that has its own independent governance structure. So Lambeth Conference can't tell the Episcopal Church what to do, or the Church of England, or the Church Fund, whatever, you know. So it's all about relationships and about praying and listening and learning together so that we can be in communion across many churches. And that's remarkable. So they're like, I think they were translating into 42 different languages. So there's a lot of language difference. And so there's takes a lot of patience. And there's a lot of cultural differences. So just understanding, even if you understand the language, understanding what it means is different. So it's long days of careful listening, care in speaking, clarifying to connect. But it's beautiful.
Right.
My Bible study had Ghana, Kenya, the Greek Archbishop of London, who's an ecumenical visitor, Sudan, Canada, England, America.
Amazing.
I mean, so it's this range of people.
So
from
y'all
there.
Had translators at each of your tables too?
Those we didn't know. All those people could speak. All of my Bible study could speak English, though that means a lot of different things.
Right. Right.
But so that's one thing. The other thing I just want to name is that you asked where did I see the Spirit? There was a dinner. One of the woman bishop of London hosted a dinner for women bishops. And the last Lambeth, I think there were 20 in 2008. And nobody was really clear how many there were because it's complicated, but nobody was really clear. But so we went to the dinner and the RSVPs had been kind of messed up. And so they weren't sure how many people were coming. They started out in a room, not as big as this, and all the tables filled. And so then they moved the divider and they were apologetic because like the other tables in the next room didn't have tablecloths and all the nice stuff. But then we filled a bunch of tables over there, 95 women bishops. And we got to hear from three women bishops. I'll only mention one, but one of them is the bishop of Amazonia in Brazil. I think the first woman bishop in Brazil, who told us about taking a boat for 30 hours to get to one of her churches. And a boat like where there's danger above the water, danger below the water, right? Pirates above, animals below. 30 hours. I will never complain again about traffic.
About your cell phone coverage.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was really inspiring to hear what other women bishops are doing. And just for those like Japan and Brazil, where there's only one woman bishop in their whole church, the gift it was for them to be with the other women was even more than it was for us.
That's amazing. And the jump, I mean, it's been a decade, right, since Lambeth was
together. 14 years.
So I don't know how many women bishops there were 10 years ago, 14 years ago.
There were like 20.
20, and now it's 95.
Yeah.
So, well, and I would say, to jump back to General Convention, that I've been going to General Convention off and on most of my priesthood, and for Dallas and for Texas, and just the makeup of the people in the room is wildly different than it was when I started.
Amen.
I mean, it was mostly people who look like me now, you know, 60-year-old white guys, you know, and 60-year-old white women. But now it is much more diverse and much younger, and it's very exciting. It just brings a whole different energy and focus. And all those people are coming out of the pews of the Episcopal Church. So in our desire to have a more diverse congregations, it's working in places. And so, and that's just sort of the power of intentional work.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
So it's very inspiring.
Good.
One of the things I noticed at General Convention, you were part of the Bishop Against Gun Violence. There was gun violence while we were in Baltimore, very close to the convention center, and a man was killed. And so you and a group of other bishops went on a walk to mark that and to go to the spot and offer a prayer. And then I haven't talked to you about this, but I heard that you also at Lambeth participated in a human dignity. I don't know if it was a march or a prayer service or whatever that was to raise the awareness and care of LGBTQ people across the Lambeth, the whole world, the Anglican Communion, excuse me. So that's obviously a really important part of your own. I mean, those weren't mandatory things. You chose to do those things. And so just tell us about your heart and how you feel led to do those things. And then what's the invitation to the rest of us to follow that lead?
I mean, I think where my heart is compelled is about solidarity with those who are marginalized and those who, you know, those who face suffering and violence. And that can be with those who are sick, but especially where the structures of our world continue to oppress people. And gun violence is one of those things in our country where, no matter, you know, if you look at gun ownership, it's certainly across cultures, races, but it's very heavily white. Though I understand that there are enough guns owned by persons in Texas that each one of us has at least 8. Now, I don't have any, so.
I've got your 8.
Some of you have my 8. And don't mishear me. I'm not, I have issues about the way we sell and allow guns, but it's not about getting rid of everybody's guns. I'm not running for governor.
But that is a lot of guns on the ground.
That's a lot of guns, but it's a lot of guns. When we have that many guns on the ground and we don't have sound laws and we don't have sound relationships with one another and communication across differences, that we can just predict lots of people are going to be killed by guns, right? And the altercation in Baltimore was between the person who was killed actually had gotten out of his car with a bat to attack some kids who were washing windshields. I mean, so there was violence and that was on both sides. But when guns are present, death is a likelihood.
Yeah, what would have been a fist fight turned into a murder.
Right.
Right.
And so we have to, we the church and we as bishops, I think, have to be in the place where the pain and suffering and the confusion of the world, that we stand there in solidarity. And at Lambeth, I have two trans kids. This is a new revelation. You all, not everybody knows this. It's not something I invite you, please don't go put it on social media. Because that's their story to tell, not mine. You know, it's their story to tell, not mine. But I don't think God wants us to hate each other because of our skin color, our language, our sexuality, our gender understanding, our height, our weight, our hair color, whatever else you want to add. I think God wants us to love each other and make room for each other. And that doesn't mean we understand everybody else and everybody else, whether it's a choice or whether it's the way they're made. We don't have to understand it to create space and affirm. And what happened at University of Kent, sorry to go on long on this, but was that the University of Kent hosts the Lambeth Conference. Even though it's called the Lambeth Conference, it doesn't actually happen at Lambeth Palace, which is much too small to hold 1,500 people. It happens at the University of Kent, which has a policy of not discriminating based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And yet, because the Archbishop of Canterbury is trying to serve a communion that has a variety of views on these things, the gay and lesbian bishops' spouses were not invited to come officially. And though they did come and there is a lot of movement forward in terms of their inclusion, the University of Kent, the students and the staff at the University of Kent organized a walk and some teaching about equality and about gender and sexuality. And so a few of us bishops walked with them as a sign. And actually, I had great conversations with these students who didn't believe that the church cared, which has been my experience when I go to the state legislature to speak against the legislation that is aimed at the exclusion and oppression of LGBTQ people, is that very few people know that the church cares about their plight. Anybody who's being scapegoated by our government and by our legislatures, we ought to figure out how to stand with them in solidarity.
So a shift, new subject.
Good.
Not to cut you off.
No,
that's good. These are important issues for St. David's. We are very clear in kind of our hope for that same thing. And I just want to hear your take on how that works.
Yeah.
But General Convention also approved the reunion. This one, I thought of while we were at clergy conference. So you didn't get this question ahead.
No, okay.
But I think it's a softball for you. General Convention also approved the reunion of the Episcopal Church in North Texas, which is the former Diocese of Fort Worth and the Diocese of Texas. And our own Jennifer Scariano is the chair of that reunion committee, and she's doing a great job in absentia.
Yes.
So Gus, when you see Jennifer, you can say, well, I was in the room when they clapped for me. Not picking on her. She is amazing. She works very hard and she's done a great job with that. I'm on that committee. And so I got to help be part of that at the clergy conference just this last week. So tell us a little bit more about that. Just your reflections on that and just briefly address
that. Well, and that was the third thing. There was such great joy when the convention voted to confirm the reunion.
It's very emotional.
It was very emotional in the House of Deputies. We were there, we were over there in that other place, but it was very, very emotional. I've seen the video. And it was especially emotional for other dioceses that had been through their own divisions in profound ways, that they felt the solidarity of the whole Episcopal Church in the action we took to reunite. So back in the 70s and 80s, we divided lots of dioceses at a time when we thought it was very important to have very, tight dioceses that could be led by one bishop and all that were culturally consistent and various things. And what we're finding out is that, running dioceses is expensive and smaller is not always better. So there will be more, think there will be more reunions or unifications where they weren't together before. But it's what the churches in that area in North Texas, it's 24 counties. So we were 57 counties and now we're either 80 or 81, depending on whether you count the half as a additional or, we're like 80 and a half counties. but what they bring, they've persisted in a time of low resources, low numbers, pilgrim type church where they have to go from place to place looking for a place to gather. They are people of great hope to bear witness to us who can be comfortable and scared at the same time about the future of the church. Comfortable because we have these beautiful buildings that we're going to restore and meet in and they give us comfort. But also scared because we know that we keep hearing about church decline, right? But so they are people of great hope. They bring to us that kind of outlook that it's like, do not be discouraged. Hold fast to what is good. That's they're those people. And the Diocese of Texas, which is a resource-rich diocese, can come alongside to help grow the church in the fastest growing urban area in the United States, right? So we only have 13 churches in 24 counties. And so we will have to do creative things, innovative things to help. We want there to be, when people look around and they want a church where everybody's welcomed, when they look around, they want the Episcopal Church. We want them to be able to find one within driving distance. Wouldn't that be a good plan?
Yeah.
So I find it very exciting. Right. But I did notice that you all are still only praying for four bishops.
Oh, yes, right. We didn't have Scott in there.
You gotta add Scott. I know it makes the prayers really long.
To
pray for all five.
Never crossed my mind. Kristen, help me remember that we need to add Scott Mayer to the list. Scott Mayer is the sitting current bishop of Northwest Texas.
Right.
And he's provisional in Fort Worth or that North Texas.
Right. So he's an assisting bishop.
Yeah. And now
he's an assisting bishop right now.
Of the Diocese of Texas.
For the Diocese of Texas.
And he's the diocesan bishop of Northwest Texas, which is the panhandle and all that.
And sometime during 2023, Bishop Doyle will call another bishop assistant to that work full time.
I'm just wondering how many miles has that man put on his car every year? that is a spread.
A spread.
I digress. All right. yes, we're excited about that. And like I said, I want to thank all those great folks who have helped make that work happen. And they are inspiring people. They have fought and bled and been sad and they have incredible endurance and incredible faith. We watched a video unrelated to the Fort Worth area It was a video about the future of this guy who he's making the 10,000 year clock.
Right.
And the last thing he said was, I have great hope for the future, not because our problems are small, but because our capacity is great.
Yes.
You know, and I just love that. And then that's what our friends in that area showed us, is they've been at it and faithful for a decade,
yeah,
continuing, and their capacity is enormous. And yes, add that to the, as you said, resource rich Diocese of Texas, our capacity is exponentially larger. So yeah, I'm really excited about that too. I want to shift to the parish a little bit. I mean, okay, there's so many things going on.
Yeah.
We could talk for hours and hours about the construction and all that. We can get out. I've told you a lot about that recently, just about where we are on that. But the thing in particular that is a new effort that we've been working on very hard for 2.5 years now at St. David's is, it started out as our anti-racism task force. And recently the vestry just turned it into a standing committee of the vestry called a racial justice committee. So it's a standing committee in the parish, standing committee of the vestry. What that means is the vestry will appoint new members to it every year. There will always be a vestry representative on that. And we expect all those committees have impact on everything that we do at the church. They're sort of part of the way I define who we are strategically. So racial justice committee, I've got to get the name right. I'm sorry. We jumped around on what it should be called. That's why it's not coming off my tongue very well. But now we're meeting with our program staff, our formation staff. How can we take these four priorities of our work into the work? And I think you're aware of some of that. And I would we mean for this to be a vital, important part of where we go for the decades to come. And I'd just love for you to reflect on this topic with us for a few minutes, especially a church that's 175 years old, previous rectors who owned slaves,
mm-hmm,
you know, and we don't have the best track record. What we have, some exciting things that happened in the Civil War and not so great things. We have some things that in the 20s that we're not that proud of, in the 40s probably that we're not that proud of. So just reflect on that whole process for us as a parish and connect it to the work that the diocese is doing, which is also pretty significant.
Yeah.
Well done. I mean, I do want to say well done on whoever the vestry members are who are here, and all of those of you who have been working on this for years. Thank you for making it a priority. And for those of you who have had some struggles over what that means and how important should it be and does it distract us, empathy, right? Empathy. Because this is a journey for all of us. I'm on the Board of Regents at Suwannee, and we're about to receive a names and places report about where they've studied all the things that are named in Suwannee after different people, who those people were and what their story is. And then how do we tell their story in ways that also don't diminish the value of their descendants of those they hurt, right? How do we become unified in this new day? I think that one thing I want to say is that we once did a strategic plan thing at Ascension, and it was we had a big workshop over a weekend. And on Monday morning, one of the most faithful members of the congregation, an older retired IBM kind of exec, sat down across from me in my office and said, I really want to help, and I want to make sure I understand. What you're saying is that we've been doing it wrong all this time? And my heart broke, right? Because in an effort to sort of walk into the future, what this faithful churchman heard was that the efforts that he had made were being judged to be unworthy. And he was trying to make the adjustment, but it was a heartbreaking moment. Yes, there are things for which we should grieve that are part of our history as a church, part of our history as a diocese. And we should name them. We should say, in those days, we as a people had leaders who owned slaves, and we regret that, but that's the truth, right? We might even want to say The church has helped perpetuate systems that continue to oppress people of color in this country. And that's been true of people of Latino origin in Texas, as well as Black people. It's not all African-American and Asian, if you study the history of America. We ought to acknowledge that and then look for the ways that our systems and structures continue to oppress people. And the church needs to be there because we're part of the systems and structures. So I want to applaud you. I want to acknowledge that it's hard and say that all of us has to sort of steel ourselves and find the internal courage to face our disappointment when we find out that our beloved great-grandfather was a racist, right? And then work for a hopeful future, believing that seeing in one another Christ, right? No matter the color of the person's skin that is facing you, no matter their language or their country of origin, that person is to represent Christ to you and you to them. And so then what does that look like? And as a community, how do we engage the work that is, you know, Austin itself has a very troubling history about race and culture and language.
Yeah.
And so when people say this project on I-35 is going to continue a legacy, we got to at least stop and listen and ask not whether it's true, but how it's true. And then what are we going to do about it? You know, so it can't be right. We're not all about racial justice. It's not the only thing the church is responsible or called to, but we cannot do the work of the gospel if we continue to ignore the oppression of certain people based on the color of their skin, right? It's actually an impediment to our life as Christians. So.
Thank you. And the church of all the people in the world, the Christian church, and I think especially liturgical Christian churches are perfectly equipped for this work, because every single Sunday we come together and say, thank you, Lord, for all these great things. I'm here are the things I'm pleased with. And I confess that I've gotten these things wrong.
Yeah.
We confess every week that we have failed. So it can't surprise us to look back in the past and say, oh, guess what? Our forebears are human beings and they got a lot of things really right. And we're really proud of those things. And
yeah.
I mean, we're worshiping an 175-year-old church that our forebears built and kept up and were a faithful witness to Jesus for all that time. And guess what? They also got some stuff wrong. That's part of how we learn about our own moral life. Say, ooh, that looked like it hurt. I don't want to do it that way. You know, I mean, it's how we learn and how we grow and how we get better at it. I think we're just perfectly, I think this is, as we talked about in confirmation class, it says, and when you sin, will you repent and turn to the Lord? It just said, it's a very pedestrian thing. It's just true. We all get it wrong. So here's our tools to deal with that. So I think we have what we need to do it.
Well, and individual, right?
Yeah.
What is true of the community of our society is also true of individuals. Like, I have learned things where I have been wrong in the past. I have gotten God's intentions wrong for me, for other people. Yeah, I mean, that sin. So what's a great Psalm 31, I think, that as long as I hid my sins, I died inside, I think is kind of where it says, not in those words. It's when I confess my sins that God is faithful and just to forgive and gives life, right? That's so we don't do any good for ourselves and others if we cling to our own ways of being broken and breaking others.
Good. Okay, we're running out of time. You're going to have to walk out of this room in the next 60 seconds.
Okay.
And here's what I'm going to ask. All right. We're going to do just several little quick, silly questions. Kristen's going to then walk with Kay out the door and you're not going to stop her. All right. Because she's going to need to go get ready for the 11:15 service. But just for real quick.
Okay.
All right. Silly trivia questions. iPhone or Android?
iPhone.
All right. Anybody happy about that? High church, low church for you personally.
Broadchurch.
Broadchurch. Okay.
That's. I love it both. I love it all. So really.
Jason Isbell or James Taylor?
Who was the first one?
Jason Isbell. Never mind. You answered the question. It's somebody you need to know. Jason Isbell is an incredible songwriter. All right. Mountains or beach?
Mountains.
Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Trek.
Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones?
Lord of the Rings. But not necessarily the current show,
that's
books.
Not Lord of the Rings, yeah, right? It's riffing on the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
The Gospel according to John or one of the Synoptics?
Luke.
All right. Very good. And you mentioned that you're a regent at Swanee. You're also an alumni of Swanee. Yay, Swanee's right. Thank you very much. And she also has a doctorate from Swanee that they gave you when you got that mitre on your head.
Nope. Southwest.
Oh, okay. All right. So anyway, you know Swanee. You lived on the mountain. Little Swanee trivia. And then we're done. What year did Swanee beat six of the current SEC powerhouses in 1 week?
1899.
Yes.
Including the University of Texas.
Yes. Yes. About
they've only played once. And Swanee has the. Yeah.
It was Alabama, Texas. It was all of them. It was all the powerhouse. All right. How many acres are on the domain?
10,000 ish.
It's 13 now.
13 now. They keep,
13,000. And who's going to be the next vice chancellor?
That's a good question.
That we're looking for what normal universities call a president right now.
Call me in February. Perhaps I can
you'll be able
tell
to
you. Yeah.
Inside. All right. Thank you very much.
It's been fun. Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.